I'm Mary Sue Demlow Dreyer, and this session is The Church as Hospitality Community Welcoming the Stranger. I wanted to tell you just a little bit about myself. My husband, Gary, and I are co-pastors in a Lutheran congregation called People of Hope, and we're the mission developers for that congregation in Rochester, Minnesota. And this is our third call that we've shared, halftime each, and People of Hope celebrated its third birthday in January. We brought three kids along with us to Holden, and that's the extent of our family, a 17-year-old, an almost 15-year-old, and an 11-year-old. And Gary is doing the Bible studies in the mornings this week. One of the other things that I wanted to share with you about me doing this topic is that before we started People of Hope, before we began that venture of planting this new church, we took a sabbatical. We were at that 10-year point in our ministry, and we decided to take some time off. And during that sabbatical, I decided that I would like to study and acquaint myself a little bit with these issues of hospitality in the church and evangelism and all that, because that seems to be a topic that a lot of people were keyed into. So I worked with a fellow named Pat Kiefert, who is a professor at one of our Lutheran seminaries, the one in St. Paul. And it turned out to be a really fun opportunity because he was working with a number of congregations who had made a commitment to spend at least 3 to 5 years on issues of congregational renewal, especially how worship and evangelism play together in renewed outreach efforts. And so I learned an enormous amount from being able during those, starting during that sabbatical, and I spent about 3 years working with these congregations in various synods, listening to brave, courageous congregations who were grappling very, very seriously with what does it mean to be the church today? What's God calling us to be? So that's why this topic has become important to me. And what I'd like to do tonight is flesh out this topic a little bit. What do I mean by hospitality community? And then state what I think I've pieced together as the reason this has become a real issue for churches today. And then I thought, let's look at the story of the prodigal son and see where that leads us as we reflect together about it. So I've been looking forward to this because it seems to me that a place like this, it provides us a real opportunity to ask some really important questions of ourselves in the church. Two things I discovered as I worked with those congregations during those several years. One is that we're really good in our churches at beating ourselves up, not as good at sitting back and celebrating the neat ways that God is at work in unique and renewing ways in our churches. And so I'd like this time to allow us some time of celebration about that God at work. The second thing that I discovered is that we do have to grapple and be very honest with ourselves about the critiques and the challenges that are facing our churches today, in the world today. So I hope this time will be a nice balance between those two things. I put up on the board the four topics in addition to the main topic that we'll be looking at. And let me just say a little bit about how I understand this hospitality community phrase. Some people were saying when I was talking about this to them, well, of course a church is a community, and of course a church is a hospitality community. And for those of us that are in the church, it is an of course. Unfortunately, there are too many people for whom that's not an of course, because they're outside the church community. So the word community, I love a definition that Susan Briel, one of the directors here, wrote in reflection of the topic for the summer. She said this is just great. The community in Christ is connected for life to one another and is a glimpse of God's great gathering. Isn't that a wonderful definition of community? Connected for life to each other and a glimpse, a little snapshot of God's great gathering. So that's what I mean when I think of this term community in relationship to a church. Now, the word hospitality, when put with that, think of people you've visited. I can recall being invited into some people's homes and being very well attended to, but getting the real message that things were very orderly in this home and that I better be minding my P's and Q's. Well, one definition of hospitality is to be attended to, but I didn't feel particularly affirmed in situations like that if I would drop my napkin or something like that. I can also recall being in people's homes where I was very affirmed, but it was so relaxed that I had to ask for anything that I needed or wanted. There, I felt really affirmed, but not really attended to. Seems to me hospitality is where both come together and where with open arms and open hearts, I'm affirmed and attended to. I don't know if all of you were already here last night. How many heard Pastor Jeff's sermon last evening at Vespers? I keep thinking all day, I've been imagining Jesus in the back of the church at that wedding, leaning against the wall, chuckling and affirming the people for who they were and flicking the handle on the drinking fountain while wine's running out of the spout, you know. Jesus both affirming and attending to the celebration. There was a guy that was holding one of these signs, a disheveled fellow, one of these cardboard signs on which with dark marker he had written, "Need food." Okay. And he stood at a Burger King just in front of where you pull up for the drive-through to order. And he was standing there with this sign, "Need food." And people would drive by him and they'd order and they'd get their meal and go on, and he'd stand there. Well, this one gentleman was about to do the same thing, and a look on this fellow's face just caught him off guard. So when he got up to order, he ordered two extra combo meals. Two, not just one, but two. And he went up and he paid and he got his food and he drove his car around and he stopped next to the fellow holding the sign and he gave him the two combo meals. And the fellow dropped his sign, held one combo meal in each hand, and started hooping and hollering and jumping around the parking lot and screaming and shouting, "This man is Jesus! This man is Jesus! Because he gave me more than I asked for." This man is Jesus because he gave me more than I asked for. Two combo meals. It seems to me that that kind of spirit of hospitality, to be affirmed and attended to beyond our what we ask for, is the nature of who God is, and hopefully maybe the nature of our congregations together. So with that as a definition of hospitality, today we're going to look at welcoming the stranger. And the question I'd like to pose for us is, what is God calling us to be or to do for the people who come to us? the people who come to our worshiping communities. Tomorrow, the topic is seeking the stranger, and I'd like to pose the question, what is God calling us to do or to be for those we might invite into our communities? So today it's the people who are coming. Tomorrow it's to push the arrows and push at the edges a little bit and ask ourselves, who might we invite into our communities? On Thursday, blessed by the stranger, I'd like us to ask the question, what is God calling us to be or to do so that we can, when new people are added to our communities, we really embrace and cherish who they are and what they bring? And then Friday, what is God calling us to be or to do so that we can truly in our church communities be no longer strangers, so that we can live without the masks that we often employ elsewhere in life, that we can be places, or that we can be fully ourselves in these places. So, for today, welcoming the stranger. How many of you come from, or feel you would say that you're connected to a church? Okay, most. What I'd like you to do right now is just turn to somebody. Yeah, this is really informal. We're going to do this three times during this hour. Have a conversation with one other person, and or if the way numbers divide up, possibly a group of three. What I'd like you to do is let's come up with some adjectives that you would use to describe your worshiping community, your church. And if you don't have one, what I'd like you to do is be a courageous voice of vision for us, and identify what the adjectives would be in a church that you would find yourself willing to be affiliated with, okay? So just take a couple minutes and share back and forth how you, if you're in the same worshiping community with somebody, great, because you still might come up with different adjectives. But see if you can kind of describe your worshiping community with several descriptive adjectives, okay? Go. We can get some adjectives up on the board to give us a context as we talk about this question of welcoming the stranger, because it's really easy to talk in theoretical terms, but it's far more productive if we can think about the worshiping community, the churches that we know and possibly love. So, a few adjectives that you found yourselves using or hearing.
Friendly.
Friendly? Others?
Accepting.
Accepting.
Caring.
Caring.
Open.
Open.
Diversity.
Diversity.
Warm and inclusive.
Okay.
Serving.
Sure.
There's a lot of overlap, but I'm just saying.
Well, but they all have a connotation.
Mm-hmm.
Serving. Any others?
Beautiful, this one that we had here.
Okay.
That's something important.
Are we going to be able to fill this side?
Fun.
Fun?
Fun?
Uh-huh. Okay.
Joyful?
Joyful? Oops. Okay.
It's not an adjective, a celebration.
I suppose that would be celebrative.
Yeah,
that's good. That's good celebration, though. It's not an English lesson, so we can put celebration down. Anything else?
Spiritual?
Spiritual.
Spiritual. Challenging.
Okay. Well, it's at any time you want to run up and add any others, this gives us a bit of a context, not only for today, but for the rest of the week. I'm a sucker for some of these family circus cartoons, and there's a wonderful one that I brought along the mother and the little girl, whatever her name is, are sitting inside a church, and they're looking out at one of the church windows, and the caption is this. The little girl says to her mom, "Churches are smart. They have pretty windows, but you have to come inside to see them." Churches are smart. They have pretty windows, but you have to come inside to see them. We can pass that around. It's still a fact in our culture that people do perceive that we have something inside our churches that's worth kind of sniffing out, checking out. And the pretty windows are sort of a symbol to me of the business that people still are coming to Christian churches as strangers, looking for something, seeking something, hoping to find something more than pretty windows, but looking for the worshiping community to maybe give them a sense of hope, a sense of meaning, a sense of home. And so the question becomes to me, why is it that we have so many treasures of faith? We have the gospel of life for all human beings. Why is it that so many people have chosen not to be a part of a church, of a Christian church? And that is a question that I think we need to really ask ourselves. It kind of states to me one of the reasons why this whole issue of hospitality in congregations has become a biggie. I remember several years ago picking up our Synod newsletter, and Synod simply means in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, the geographical area of the church that I'm affiliated with, the Southeastern Minnesota Synod. And they have a regular newsletter. And I was picking it up, and there was a report from the Synod statistician, who incidentally happens to be on the Holden Board of Directors. And she was writing about the State of the Union according to the previous year's year-end reports. And that year, it showed that our Southeastern Minnesota Synod churches had done pretty well, but overall there were some pretty good growth places here and there, but overall we had suffered just a slight decline in total membership. And I remember reading that and thinking, in the light of increasing population, especially worldwide, to decline a little is to lose a whole lot of ground if more and more people are being born all the time. So then I went to a church seminar on how to plant a church, and in preparation for our work to start People of Hope, and I heard somebody say to us, you know, if your congregation is not bringing people to faith and baptizing people, then your church is a dead link in the chain of Christianity. Whoa. That one really hit me hard, because the most successful form of Lutheran evangelism has usually been marriage and procreation, and that's not working very well anymore, because people aren't necessarily having large families, and those children are not necessarily going to go to a Lutheran church or even a Christian church. And so I think we have some real challenges before us as Christian churches, and I'm just speaking from what I've observed in Lutheranism. There's this guru in innovative business practices called Tom Peters. Anybody ever heard of him? Tom Peters says that it's absurd to keep doing what you've always been doing and expect to get different results. And I think it kind of applies to our churches. Or to say it another way, and this is my favorite cartoon, Calvin and Hobbes. There's this one great, I'm always getting them confused though. Calvin's the kid, right? And Hobbes is the tiger? Tiger, all right. So there's this one sequence where Calvin is sitting and he's hard at work on the floor coloring. And Hobbes comes along and says, looks over his shoulder and he says, "What you doing?" And Calvin says, "I'm coloring in my new paint by number book, or color by number book." And Hobbes looks for a while and there's a silent frame. And then he says, "Yeah, but Calvin, you're not using the colors that match up with the numbers." And Calvin looks up at him and retorts, "Well, if I did that, I'd get the picture on the box." If we keep on doing what we've been doing, we won't get any different results. And it might just be a time where God's calling the church to color outside the lines or to try some new things for the sake of the gospel. Now, I've always been in a church. And my husband, Gary, when he did the Bible study this morning, mentioned a fellow named Warren Quanbeck, who was my advisor at the seminary when I was a student. And I remember the very first day of seminary, there were four of us who were Dr. Quanbeck's advisees, and we were gathered around him. And we were each to tell our story of the church, or our story, and how we happened to be coming to seminary. And the other three people in my advisee group had stories of great, the word that comes to me is angst, stories of great struggle and times where they had departed from the church and felt that they couldn't be a part of it for one reason or another. And then they all had wonderful stories of rediscovering the gospel and finding themselves in churches. And got to me, and I kind of said, "Well, mine's sort of a boring story. I've always been in a church. I've always kind of liked church. I even like hour and a half worship services." And Dr. Quanbeck looked at me and he said, "Don't apologize. You have experienced the church in the way that we would hope people could experience the church." So, in all of my years in being part of the church, there has been one refrain that I have heard frequently. See if you've ever heard this. "We don't see them anymore after they're confirmed." Oh, you've heard this too. And then they come back when it's time to get married. Yeah, to get married. And then we don't see them again after the wedding until, sure enough, they have a baby in arms and they expect us to baptize them. And then we don't see them again. Well, until it's time to train those kids, whether they start them in Sunday school early or maybe later, closer to confirmation. And then the whole cycle begins again. And I've heard this. Apparently you have too. Well, the good news is that that's not happening so much anymore. The bad news is they're not coming back at all. They're not coming back at all. Because now we have the generation that was just brought back for the baptism and the 2 years of confirmation and the wedding, and they don't see the sense in it. And so they're not darkening the door of the church as often anymore. I really think that that lament, we will look back on it and find that that was the golden age of the church in my years, when at least they came back and we could talk again. That's why this fellow named Loren Mead, who was for many years the head of the Alban Institute, has these two wonderful books out, The Once and Future Church, and then another book called Transforming Churches for the Future. And in The Once and Future Church, Loren Mead tells us, we're on a mission field. We're on a mission field like we haven't been on a mission field since the time of the early church. And in this book, he challenges us to color outside the lines for the sake of the gospel. In fact, his opening line in this book is, everyone I know who works in churches knows there's trouble. Churches don't work the way they used to. So we are on a mission field. And another church consultant named Kenan Callahan has told us that if we keep doing things the way we're doing them now in the church, that we have about 20 years. We have about 20 years for the church to do business as usual, the way it's been doing, and then who knows what's going to happen. But we will have lost yet another generation, and we will really be out on mission outposts. Given that, how do we welcome those who come to see the pretty windows from the inside? How do we welcome those people who, for one reason or another, have not chosen earlier or previously to be part of a church and decide to come back to us? What I'd like you to do is sit back and recall a time when you really, really felt that you were the recipient of someone's hospitality. A time where you really felt both affirmed and attended to. And while you sit back and think about that, I'd like us to turn to the prodigal son story, which I really prefer to call the prodigal father story, because prodigal means extravagant, and watch who the real extravagant one is in this story. It's Luke chapter 15. Now, Jesus gives us some guidance on how to welcome the stranger in this story, and maybe it's a familiar story to some of you. Sit back, think about hospitality as you've experienced it. Excuse me, and I'm going to read a portion of this story. But first, hear again why Jesus told this story. Luke 15:1. Now all the tax collectors and the sinners were coming near to listen to him. And the Pharisees and the scribes were grumbling and saying, this fellow welcomes sinners and eats with them. Then Jesus told two other parables, the story of the lost sheep, the story of the lost coin, and then the longer and final story in the chapter, the prodigal father story. There was a man who had two sons. Then the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the share of the property that will belong to me. And so, quite amazingly, I think, the father divided his property between them. Extravagant to begin with, that he followed his son's request. All right, verse 13 is where I am for those of you who are following along. A few days later, the younger son takes off. Says he gathered all he had and he traveled to a distant country, getting out of there. And there he squandered his property in dissolute living. And when he'd spent everything, a severe famine took place throughout the country and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him to his fields to feed the pigs. Now, if the fellow in the story is a Jew, this is an indeed outrageous task for him because pigs were unclean. Verse 16. The son would gladly have filled himself with the pods that the pigs were eating, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, he said, "How many of my father's hired hands have bread enough and to spare? And here I am dying of hunger." Light bulb. I will get up, go to my father, and I'll say to him, "Father, I've sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me like one of your hired hands." So he sets off. He's got his speech memorized, and he sets off. Sets off, went to his father. And you can just imagine this kid practicing this speech all the way home from this distant country. He knows just what he's going to say when he sees his father. But while he was still far off, his father saw him. You get the impression that this father wasn't just casually walking by the picture window and got a glimpse. You get the impression the father might have just been watching for him to come back someday. So, while he was still far off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion. He ran, put his arms around him, and kissed him. And then the son says, I mean, he's got his speech memorized, right? So he launches into it. And then the son said to him, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son." That's where the speech ends in the recording in Luke. Now, it's a curious question. Did the father cut the speech off before the son said, "Make me just one of your hired servants"? Or was the son deciding after all that memorizing to go for broke and maybe see if he couldn't be restored? It's hard to, we don't know. All we know is that as far as the speech goes, he says, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son." But the father said to his slaves, "Quickly, bring out a robe, the best one. Put it on him, put a ring on his finger, sandals on his feet, get the fatted calf, kill it, let's eat, celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." And they began to celebrate. And just when he gets the one kid back into the house, this gatherer father has to go back outside and try to coerce the older, now infuriated brother who stayed around and has been working his fingers on the bone to also come in. This incessant, exuberant, extravagant gatherer dad who couldn't get these two into the same place. There is celebration in heaven when you and I repent. There is celebration over me and over you when we take that path back to Jesus, back to God. We're worth celebrating over. I think it's an incredible part of the story. No matter what path we've been on, there's celebrating in heaven over us. This great feast of celebration. This is, unfortunately, how I think we often in the church have rewritten this lesson. Imagine the story as it was told up to the point when the son's walking on back down the path. And it says, while he was still far off, his father saw him. Too often I think we rewrite this lesson like this. In the way we practice our hospitality, our reluctant hospitality in the church. You might imagine, while he was still far off, the parent sees him and goes, "Oh, there he is. I've been kind of wondering. wondering when he was going to come back. And then he goes into his study and he puts on his smoking jacket and he lights up his pipe and he waits. And he lets the kid walk up the long path and past the old tree that he used to climb as a kid and past the mailbox, rehearsing his speech all along. And then pretty soon the parent hears the knock on the door. He knows who it is. He knows it's this one that he's been wondering where he's been. And he decides to wait till he knocks a second time. And then he hears that knock a second time. And he gets up and he opens the door and he peers at this one over his glasses and he says, "Yes." And he lets the kid spill his prepared speech out. And then he opens the door wide and he says, "Well, come on in and we'll have a long talk about where you've been and what you've been up to." My fear is that that is the reluctant welcome that too many have experienced in coming back to the church or coming into a church as strangers. This fellow that I, well, I'll tell you that one later. When in one of our calls, I was the pastor who was in charge of new members and evangelism at the largest church in Rochester, 4,500 some members. And there was one woman, we'll call her Brenda, that had been coming to talk to me for some time, but she had never come to worship service. And this woman, it took all of her courage to walk into the church office the first time she came and asked to talk to me. And it took her a lot of courage each time she came back. And she was a struggling person in body and in spirit and in soul. And I would invite her to come to church and she'd go, oh no, I can't do that. I wouldn't know what to do. It'd make me too nervous. And I would invite her and she, no, I'd be too scared. One day, as people were pouring into worship, I saw Brenda walk in and she had her little granddaughter with her. And it just so happened that Sunday, my husband Gary was up, and we always had this routine that when one of us was on duty, the other one was parent up for that week. So I was sitting in the congregation in the pews, and I ended up about two pews behind where Brenda and her granddaughter were sitting. Well, it was clear. Neither of them had been in a church before. It was real clear the granddaughter had never been in a church. She was unruly, she was noisy, she didn't know what was up, she just didn't. And I felt so sorry for Brenda trying to contain this grandchild and try to figure out what to do in a worship service. Well, the service got over and I had to stop in the office on my way out to pick up something. And I walked into the office and there was one of these stilted, strange silences in the office, and people were doing the, you know, rolling their eyes back and forth. And then I looked over in the far corner of this office was Brenda, just doubled up and crying and shaking. And she kept saying, "I'll never come back, I promise, I'll never come back, I promise." Come to find out that the person who had been sitting in front of her in the worship service had turned around after her, after the service was over, and had said to her, until you can teach that child how to act in church, it would be better if you both didn't come back. Mm-hmm. You feel maybe how I felt. If anyone would have known what it had taken for her to come, and how she had brought that child as her comfort, and to be told by a woman who I know is a real sweetie pie, who just had been bugged up to as far as she could take it by the noise that child had made that day, had told this woman off, probably in a moment of frustration that maybe she still regrets to this day. But there was Brenda. I promise, I won't come back. I don't know if she ever did. But these are subtle ways that I think that we in our churches have sometimes blocked the road back for people. Now, Holden being what it is, and the hour being what it is, what I'd like you to do is to go into those same dyads, and if you could add Leslie, who we didn't get to participate in one when we first started. What I'd like us to brainstorm about is, what are some of those barriers to the road back to God's house that you've either experienced or observed or maybe have heard other people experience? What are some of those things that have been subtle messages from our churches that the people we supposedly are here to provide hospitality to have gotten messages from us of quite the other nature? Let's work together on what is the problem? What is the challenge? According to what you've seen and what you've experienced, what are the barriers on the road back to church for the stranger? Let's take a couple, 2, 3, 4 minutes. And then when you're done, what I'd like is to ask if any of you would like to offer any ideas or thoughts for the whole group to hear. So, but you won't have to if you don't want to. So take a few minutes and talk about that. Collect your observations and see what we've got. What do we have facing us in your observation of things?
One thing, being busy with other responsibilities, like with the children or with the choir, having to rehearse before service, and so not being there to welcome and to sit with and be with the person that I was wanting to bring.
So more than just having greeters, official greeters. You talked about sitting with, actually sharing in the experience with someone, and not being able to do that because we're busy.
Yeah.
I guess not being attentive to someone new coming in, and not feeling, being kind of open to that. And again, just being kind of into your own activity at the moment, before or after the service. Uh-huh.
We've got this one amazing woman among People of Hope who, she comes up to me after church and she'll often say, "I met 3 new people today." And she's just a wonder because she's attentive to that and she looks for them. Other thoughts?
I think there's a big an older brother attitude. When we hear this story, we've all heard the story 100 times. Some people will identify, with the father, they'll identify with the prodigal son. But I think that most people, most of the time, are the older brother. And they feel resentful. We're good boys, we're good girls, we play by the rules. We expect to inherit all this because we've done it right. And, that was one of the purposes of the whole story in Jesus' time, to say that, the rules are, one who shows up at 10 o'clock gets paid as the same as the one who showed up at 6 o'clock.
Yeah, yeah.
But that attitude, it's really kind of a human, nature, especially when the church is part of, like, the dominant church in a status quo, you know, then you kind of live by the rules, and, you know, the Pharisees are kind of in charge. And so I think it's that older brother attitude that makes it, because people can see that, you know.
And it begs the question of whose church is this?
Yeah.
And Pat Kiefert, that I worked with beginning that sabbatical year, tells a wonderful story of going to church once with his grandma. And there were a number of them that day there visiting with grandma, going to grandma's church. And they were walking into church before the service was to start. And grandma was leading the group, and all of a sudden she stopped dead in her tracks in the aisle and wouldn't go into a pew. And so everybody came to her to go in, and she stood there shaking her head. Somebody was sitting in her spot. And she did not move until one of the family went over to the newcomer and said, "Would you please move over? That's my grandma's spot." And if we think that's not a big issue, when newcomers start coming to churches and start taking our parking places and our positions on council, just watch what happens in a congregation. Others, you had your hand up.
Well, I was just saying a basic mentality I fight as a pastor, a consumer mentality towards church. I go, people go to for what they can get.
That's true.
Church, like we do, we go to stores. So with that mentality, if you walk in with that mentality, you're not looking for opportunity.
I think it's Kiefert again who says, that is our society, as you said, and our task in the church is to welcome the stranger and make consumers into disciples. Let them see that what they came shopping for is so small in comparison to the Jesus that we can offer them, that they can't help themselves to abandon consumerism for discipleship. But who to do that?
I think the welcoming part is crucial to get in the door, in the pew, into the service. But you also have to communicate a need for the gospel, that we need it, that we have to have it, that it's life-giving. And when someone is hit over the head with that for the first time, or said it in a way, they're going to be back. I think it all has to work together. But you can have the friendliest place, but if it's empty and superficial, the worship, they're not going to be back, I don't think. There's got to be some real food there to partake of.
To begin to not just feed into more consumerism,
yeah,
but to offer them this treasure that we have to share.
I'd like to reiterate those thoughts and agree with them, and also what this gentleman was saying, that this consumer society that we have and so forth is one which we've been at for a very long time, and our human nature motivates us toward that it will deliver a good life. And it's so easy for us as humans to overlook that the Christian message is so simple, and it's one of love, and that when someone walks into the church, that we greet them as they are honoring us, as the prodigal son story is supposed to teach us, I think. Honoring us by coming to worship God with us. And we're not welcoming them to, say, a Lutheran church or a Presbyterian or any other. And thus emphasizing this consumer thing, because I suspect that a great many people who have not been in church for a long time but are thinking that maybe this Sunday I will go and seek one are doing so because they have not found their inner needs met by all of the good material things. And it would seem that at the point that our consumer society has reached today, that our churches should be beginning to boom because we are offering the one answer that gives that inner peace and fulfillment.
The thing
so
that
often as humans, we present it in the same old way that Walmart or someone else might, in a sense, by the way we interact with the persons that come to you.
The thing I love about this prodigal father story is that it becomes God's welcome. God's welcome to us. And when somebody new comes into our churches, they are the same as us, welcomed by God like we are. We are a company of strangers, equally welcomed by God each time we walk into the door. And so that question of whose church is it, it's God's church. And what is God doing here? And what is God calling us to be? And even Grandma, who had a pew that just fit her perfectly because she'd been sitting in it for 75 years, had to realize that that church is God's church. And this is one place where we really run into trouble in welcoming the stranger. But we got about 5 more minutes. What do you think changes when we begin to see this as God's church? And that we who come, whether we're the pastors up front or the newcomer or the regular attendee or the occasional attendee, that every Sunday we're on the same plateau, welcomed by God, no matter what. That it is God's will. What happens to our welcome of the stranger when we begin to look at it like that? And what happens when we begin to see our worship services as public events that celebrate God's redemptive work and not the private family gathering? What happens? How do we talk about welcoming the stranger in the context of the prodigal father story? Got some concrete ideas? I heard up here you were talking about worship services and finding your way into through a Lutheran liturgy. Are there things about the way we worship that we could think about in new ways if we're talking about welcoming the stranger to God's house?
Well, in our church, we got a bulletin. It's got 3 services in it. It's got two hymnals they use, and musical inserts. And if you're not in a Lutheran background, a new person coming in, they just get completely lost. You have to help them out.
Sit with them, like you said. You know, when we began People of Hope worship, we decided that that was one problem and that we were going to eliminate all of that. We weren't going to buy hymnals. We were just going to print out what we call our worship guide. And it's real simple, low budget, 11, or what are the size sheets?
8 by 11.
Yeah, threefold, low budget, but everything's in there. Mm-hmm. Everything you have to know, every song, is the words are printed out. It just follows from beginning. Now when I go to another church, I used to be real good at bouncing through those pieces. Now I go, and I'm worse than anybody because I'm fumbling. It's really, we get pretty good at it and don't realize we're juggling.
We had the, why don't you tell the story of the Easter visitor we had? Someone brought their mother?
Yeah, somebody brought her mother to People of Hope Worship one Easter, and this is a person that's been have visited a little bit, but that was at first, and now she's not going to worship very often. And so I was really surprised to see her, and that she brought her mother to Easter worship. And so I ran into her later, and I asked her, say, I said I was really happy to see you at Easter worship, but curious, because we had talked about why she wasn't coming regularly. Why didn't you come and bring your mom on that Easter Sunday? And she goes, well, you really want to know? I said, yeah, hit me with it. And she said, because mom's getting older, and I wanted her to go someplace where it was easy for her to worship. And I thought, I don't feel insulted by that. It was a wonderful recognition that, indeed, just by simplifying, it had become more welcoming to that elderly person. And so it's not just younger people. Other thoughts?
Well, the reason we have this bulletin like that, and we have three distinct services, and I think it is to appeal to different people. Like, we go to the contemporary service, there's more of a traditional service at 11, and then we have a jazz service at night that, you know, so in this way, I think we're reaching people mm-hmm. that, and just, but maybe we should do something with the bulletins.
Yeah. Could you run three different
bulletins?
Yeah.
Well, I used to, but this is supposedly simple.
Budget.
I think for the people making the bulletins, it probably did.
You know, if we're coming outside the lines here for the sake of the gospel, none of us are experts on this new mission field. We got to try some things. Yeah.
Just a quick little story. When I was up at school, a Japanese foreign exchange student was visiting for a year, and they don't have a lot of churches over in Japan, so. My friend and I brought him to a church. We convinced him to go, and we were actually an hour early. Mass started later than we thought. We went to a Catholic Mass, but we're Lutheran, but that was just convenient at the time. And so we stood outside, we talked about the whole message, about how God loves us and how Jesus died for us. You know, give him a brief overview about what he's going to learn in church. And the service was absolutely horrible. They showed a film strip instead of a sermon, you know, to give money, and a lady like passed out and service continued, you know, and I think it was really disappointing because he didn't want to go back. And I think it's important for churches that at every single service, somehow they incorporate the fact that Christ crucified for us at every service, because there's always going to be a new person who either this is their first time, you know, or maybe their last.
Or maybe their last. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I think to be innovative in liturgy can really work.
Yeah.
But we come from a place where, you know, that is very, you know, very traditional. We operate out of the Book of Common Prayer, and it's the same service, and it's a very high service with wonderful, you know, with wonderful music. And it's very beautiful, and that has, you know, that creates an ethos, you know, in that church of, well, you know who owns the house, to quote somebody. When you're there, you know who owns the house, and it's such a wonderful, beautiful experience that the people over and understand that. Their needs or their desires really aren't the most important thing for them to be thinking about when they're there. You know, is this convenient for me? Is this easy for me? You know, to be a part of that very beautiful corporate worship. You know, that's another way that it can be successful too. And I know our church has been extremely successful, growing very strongly and very meaningful. So that's, you know, kind of 180 degrees.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, that can work that way too.
Yeah. Let's close with prayer. It's time for us to adjourn to Vespers. Let's pray. Dear God, thank you for your churches. And thank you that you welcome us and cause great celebration over us. Help us, Lord. Help us to see the unique ways that you are inviting us to be welcoming to others as you have been to us. Amen.
Amen.